Your Holiness, I don't want to preempt any questions you might have for Professor Davidson, but if you don't have any right now, and we'll have more time for discussion,
yes,
perhaps we would move on to our second presentation, yes, with Dr. Seron, who's going to tell you about some work that moves from the laboratory into the real life of contemplative practice.
Your Holiness, it's an honor and a privilege to be able to share our work with you again, to give you a bit of an update on what we've been doing for a number of years. And I'm very grateful for Mind and Life and all of you to have come here to partake in this feast of ideas and interchange. And as soon as the projector is on, I will.
Up in the control booth.
Ah.
Thank you.
Well.
Almost. There it is. Thank you.
So today, Your Holiness, I'm going to present a talk with two main points. The first point is I'm going to present a little bit of information about the design of our long-term research project, the Shamatha Project, as an example of multiple ways that we can investigate the effects of contemplative practice. We've already heard that simply focused attention meditation may produce bodily healing, may result in emotional regulation, may actually change attention. There may be many different consequences of engaging in contemplative practice. The second thing I'm going to do is to speak more directly to how such training might impact our encounter with suffering directly. So I'm going to give an overview of our research project. So in 2007, Alan Wallace, now Alan Wallace needs no introduction to you, he's been your student and friend for decades, but for the rest of the audience not familiar with Alan, Alan is a Buddhist scholar, author, contemplative teacher, and translator, and who we met in the 1990 Mind and Life meeting. And he had already at that time the idea that directed attention, focused attention meditation would be very amenable to scientific research, and brought the idea for an intensive project to us in UC Davis, where I work. So what we did is we created 2 3-month meditation retreats. These were full-time residential trainings in the mountains of Colorado. And we took 60 meditators and we randomly assigned half of them to the first 3-month retreat and the second 30 to a second 3-month retreat. Those in the second 3-month retreat became a control group. Because, you know, not everybody can have 3 months to go full-time and meditate. So the bit of self-selected nature of the population, the control group controls for that. And we tested the control group just the same way we tested the retreat group. This age range of these retreatants was about 22 to 69. They'd all had some meditation experience. Alan's training had a primary emphasis on cultivating relaxation, the stability of attention, perceptual clarity, and one example practice is mindfulness of breathing, and for those of you who are interested, this is all described in Alan's book, The Attention Revolution. But along with the training... I don't have any earring. The beard, well, we could just... Okay. So along with this attention stabilization training, Alan taught 4 key attitudes for considering oneself and others. Loving kindness, compassion, empathetic joy, and equanimity, or a sense of impartiality. So, since there are so many things that could be affected by such an intense training, we developed a very comprehensive set of assessments. We had daily experience questionnaires. We had a whole variety of questionnaires from social psychology about personality, different psychological traits at the beginning and end. We had structured interviews asking people about their goals and worldviews and what it was like to meditate so much. We had attention-related laboratory tasks, attention-emotion interaction tasks, emotion-related tasks, and we also asked people to meditate in the laboratory. I'm going to talk about some emotion-related tasks. And it was a multidisciplinary study in terms of the measures we took. We used brainwave measurements. We measured autonomic nervous system activity, heart rate, skin conductance, respiration, blood pressure. We measured a startle response of the eye blink, the muscle tension response to loud sounds. We looked at performance on cognitive tasks. We looked at facial expressions of emotion. We have done thematic analysis of these interviews, what people, the different values they report. And we collected a host of biomarkers. Today I'll just talk a little bit about some autonomic measures and the facial expressions. So the first experiment that I want to talk about relates to changes in your physiological response to the perception of suffering. We presented images of human suffering. And we're also going to then talk about changes in facial expression. So in an experiment that actually presented a loud sound that would produce one a startle, we presented positive, neutral, and negative images. And the negative images we sorted into images of illness, loss, disease, or threatening images, violence threatened by people, or threatening animals. This work is spearheaded by a graduate student in my laboratory, Brandon King. So I'm going to ask you all to prepare your minds to see some graphic images. So these are examples of images in the suffering category. These are images in the threat-related category. One of the things that we noticed at the beginning of the retreat, the control group and the retreat group have a kind of overlapping pattern of their heart rate deceleration. This is a graph that on the vertical axis, this is your heart rate slowing down, and this is a graph of time. These are seconds. And this is relative to the heart rate that you had when the picture came on in the 1 second before. After the retreat, we see a remarkable pattern. The retreatants, the trainees, have an increased deceleration. Their heart rate slows more, specifically in response to images of suffering. The groups... The control group in this blue line, they actually have a decreased response. But the groups don't differ at all in terms of the response to the threatening stimuli. What's really interesting about this is that individuals who show the pattern of heart rate deceleration when they see images of needy people actually endorse an increased desire to help. This is the work of Nancy Eisenberg, who's actually also come to Dharamsala and talked to you. So the pattern we see from this experiment is one that may relate to an increased engagement with suffering and willingness to contribute something to ameliorate it, maybe in line with the development of compassion.
Mm-hmm. 고급 이상 위협이지 리서치 나가지 돈을 떼어 버렸어. 그래서 다 고민 때문에 게임기 휴게트 도서.
Now I'm going to talk of.
지난 친기 돈을 내가 개발하면 도서 고민 때문에 맞아 맞아 네가 그 트레블라.
I'm going to talk about another experiment where we presented emotional films and we unobtrusively videotaped people and we coded their facial expressions using your friend Paul Ekman's coding system that he developed with Wally Friesen. And this is also going to be some difficult to see images. Here is an image of a woman watching the scene on the left. These are from a documentary about the Iraq War. This work is spearheaded by Erica Rosenberg, who has talked with you at Stanford. Tony Zanesco and Brandon King, also graduate students in the lab. Here's another image. Here's an image of a soldier talking about how difficult it was to encounter the suffering of families, husbands carrying dead children, dead wives. So what's our hypothesis? We think that after the training in focused attention and these key attitudes, we're going to have less of a pushing away of suffering, more of an ability to encounter it without defensiveness. So we think...
中途这边，中途这边的经济上，东岸太原这块，东岸的越新的东岸越到马家不行，这里阳光是九五年的罗马钱，第一天晚上都是。And
by pushing away, we specifically mean reactions of anger, disgust, and contempt. And in its place, we may see, we expect more of sadness. Because what is the natural response to seeing this kind of suffering? So here is an example of a sad face of this woman. And these numbers correspond to just 12 seconds of coding using the facial action coding system. Every single video frame that there is a movement on the face is noted. The muscle group that contracts is noted, its intensity and its offset. And we take this database of facial expression and put it into a dictionary for co-occurring muscle movements that define different emotional expressions. So what do we see in terms of sadness? We had another film that we showed before the retreat began, you know, at the beginning, for both groups. And before the retreat, both the trainee and the control groups do not differ in how likely they are to show sadness, or if they show sadness, how many sadness expressions they have. After the retreat, it's more likely for retreatants, for the trainees, to show sadness expressions. The groups do not differ in how many expressions they show, if they do show. But 20% of the control group showed sadness after 3 months, and 50% of the retreat group, the trainees, showed sadness. So after training, they're more likely to show sadness. What about rejection emotions? Before the retreat, there are no differences between the groups on rejection emotions, either in likelihood or the number of responses. After the retreat, they were equally likely to show a rejection emotion. About 70% of all participants showed anger, contempt, or disgust. But the trainees showed significantly fewer of these emotional expressions.
Oh my God. That wasn't very clear.
Okay. Okay, so what in terms of sadness, we're talking about likelihood.
That was fine.
Here, both groups do show some rejection, but the trainee group, the retreatants, show less number of expressions. So there's fewer rejection expressions overall. So it just, we could summarize by saying less rejection emotions after training. We now look at what people say. Okay. So now we're going to ask people what they felt when they were showing sadness. And this is sort of my final point. After people saw the film, we showed them a kind of storyboard, a set of pictures from the film. And we knew when they reported that what they were feeling every 2 seconds of the film when their emotions changed. And we looked at what they said they were feeling when they showed expressions of sadness. After the retreat, trainees reported significantly higher ratings of sympathy and distress, but not higher ratings of sadness. The sadness expression does not directly refer to the feeling of sadness. It refers to the feeling of sympathy. There was no relationship between sadness expressions and sympathy ratings in the control group. So this is my final point here. The findings throw into question the meaning of this sadness expression after training in compassion. It suggests that they may be markers of a training-related growth of other-directed empathic concern. And that's what I want to tell you about today. So I have an extraordinary team of scientists at Davis and elsewhere, a whole host of consulting scientists, some of whom are here, and I'm incredibly grateful, as we all are, for our generous funding. Thank you.